My name is Stephen Slaughter, and this is the Envisioning Education Podcast. I'm a teacher on a quest for better ways to support learning. Over the past 17 years, I have taught across the grade levels 1, 5, 7, 8, 9, 11, and 12 in both public and private schools operating in conventional educational models. In the past year, I've been moving more and more toward approaches where children have greater control in what they're doing. When I taught middle school English, I shifted to most reading happening independently, with students selecting their own books. And several years ago, a teaching partner and I began a semester-long unit called the 20% Project, in which eighth graders were given a day a week in our classes, 20% of their time, to work on ambitious personal passion projects. Kids have written novels, built computers, studied sports physiology, created YouTube channels, designed and sewed clothing, and hundreds of other projects over the years. Their content skills occurred naturally within their projects, writing business letters to potential mentors, conducting research organizing their projects through blogging and calendar tools, and engaging in informational reading. One boy who built a motorcycle hated reading novels, but was fine reading technical manuals. Contrast this kind of sticky learning to my comment in the first episode about students cramming facts into their heads for the exam, only to forget it right away. The more I've experimented with these kinds of activated real-world learning experiences, the more convinced I've become that this is how authentic learning happens. Recently, I've been asking adults I meet, what do you know a lot about, and how did you come to that knowledge? Ask yourself that question. Almost always, it was driven by genuine fascination by the topic. It was important to us personally. If this is true for adults, why do we think it would not be the same for kids? In his book Drive, business writer Daniel Pink studies what most motivates people. The three strongest motivators, he concludes, are autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Each of these qualities are present in the 20% Project. And for most students in most of their school subjects, those qualities are not really present at all. After my interview with Rusty Keeler in episode 1, we had lunch in the town square, and I returned to the Anarchy Zone for my second interview with Matt Jarman. I had hoped to introduce them, since they both lived in Ithaca and have a lot in common, but their schedules didn't work out for that day. Matt and I met this summer during an online facilitator's training for Agile Learning Centers. He's in the process of launching Communitas, a really fascinating vision that I think you'll enjoy hearing about. Here's our interview, this time seated at a picnic table under some breezy trees inside the Anarchy Zone itself. Hey, Matt.
Hello.
It's good to see you.
Good to see you.
In person, as you said, it's good to see you with like a human body attached to your Zoom face.
Right. I wondered. Yeah.
So, Matt Jarman, we are in Ithaca, New York, and I just had my interview with Rusty. And we're in the same space. We're at the Anarchy Zone. We met on Zoom during the Agile Learning Center facilitator training this summer.
Right.
So we're both looking into models of self-directed education. Can you just start by just telling us about how did you get to the point where you were thinking, you got to the stage of saying, like, I actually want to create a school, learning center, whatever you plan to call it. It's a road to get there, I think. Mm. Like, what was that road like for you?
Yeah. I think my wife and I, when we had our first child, who's almost 7 now, so around 7 years ago, we started just kind of thinking for the first time about education for kids. And so we were reading, looking into some stuff, and when I read Peter Gray's Free to Learn book, I'm a psychologist, I'm a research psychologist myself, and so that really spoke to me because, you know, come at it from kind of a similar perspective. And so at that point, I kind of realized that we had to do self-directed education, like that, like we're both on the same page. So at that point, then we had to kind of figure out what that looked like for us, and we moved to Virginia for a job. I was starting a position as a psychology professor, and it was a small town, and and there weren't options for self-directed education. And I know, you know, there are different approaches to self-directed education, and it, Peter Gray speaks about the importance of that mixed age kind of space where kids can interact with kids of different ages. And so we knew that we wanted that. We wanted that kind of intergenerational mixed age community. And so since it wasn't there, we figured we should try to do it ourselves. And we tried, and it didn't really pick up any momentum. There are a few, you know, things that seemed promising, but then they kind of flopped. And so then finally we moved here to Ithaca because we thought that this would be a space that was a little, a city that was more conducive. The town we were in before was extremely small. So we haven't started yet, but it seems promising so far. We're making good connections in the community, and
Have you felt like this is the kind of town that will just be more supportive of the ideas?
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And with our approach to the center, social justice is also a central kind of theme. We definitely see self-directed education through a kind of anti-oppressive kind of lens, and I think that it's, you know, it's a pretty progressive town that has a lot of people who care a lot about social justice, and so in many ways that kind of tends to be our focus in terms of kind of outreach. We're not necessarily focusing on people who are already homeschooling. I mean, we definitely want to talk to them as well, but more people who care about social justice and might not have considered kind of how education is itself kind of a, you know, oppressive kind of institution fundamentally, right? You're forcing people to do something against their will, right? So we think that message could resonate with people here.
Okay, so as you're an academic, you're a professor. I don't know if, like, we haven't talked about early years or anything. Did you go to any sort of progressive schools at any point?
Me? No.
When you were younger?
No. Public school and yeah.
Yeah. So, like, I think we're similar in that, I don't know, that shift over time. And I've been teaching for a long time now, in conventional schools, both public and private. But I feel like the things that I've done that with my students in conventional schools that were more student directed, where kids had some autonomy, wherever I could slip it in, were the best things for kids, looking back on it.
Sure.
The idea of giving kids more time to do that is kind of exciting.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So are you, one of the things that is kind of front and center in my mind right now, and it's part of my journey that I'm on right now, one of the things I want to talk about with anybody that I can, especially those who are running centers already, is the big nagging question. I think one of the big hurdles for many parents, even parents who are interested or sympathetic to Montessori, that aren't, you know, just classical in their approach, that are kind of open-minded about things, I feel like there's still going to be a difficulty understanding or accepting the idea that children will come to all the pieces of knowledge that they need to on their own without any kind of formal structure. Mm-hmm. So I'm still wondering that myself. I'm not 100% sold on that, which is why I want to see it in action. Where are you on that question?
Yeah.
The ALC folks are really all sold out on that, but are you there yet too?
Yeah, I think I am. I think there are two angles that I view it from. First of all, you know, who really knows what are the necessary, you know, topics? Like, I think back to, you know, my own, like, high school and college. I remember next to nothing, you know, aside from just learn to read and write, you know, and do math, you know, like basic math. I don't remember anything. I remember vividly finishing college, you know, went to UCLA, finished my degree there. And I remember thinking, I'm not better prepared to do anything right now than when I started. Like, there's nothing that I would feel like, yeah, I could do this now.
Yeah.
With this education. And not to knock the education, it's just it didn't give me, you know. Yeah. So the first question, you know, when people say, "Oh, but how are they going to learn these things?" Well, just because there's this fundamental assumption that because you took a class and you passed the class that you will somehow necessarily retain that knowledge and be able to use it, right? So that's a big assumption, and I think most of us can reflect back and we don't often, you know. So and that's okay, right? Like I'm not suffering for the fact that I don't remember my, you know, what I learned in history and what I, you know, because I don't need it right now. And yeah. The stuff I need, I learn as needed, you know.
Well, and that's just one assumption, right? Among many. Like there's that, like, will I retain it? I mean, another question that goes with that, of course, is like, who decided that this particular thing is helpful or valuable?
Okay.
And to whom, you know, like certain higher level math concepts are only valuable to really a handful of people. And having taught high school, I've asked kids many times, just out of my own curiosity, how much they retain, number one, but also like they don't know why they have to take calculus. You know, sure. They don't know why. I don't want to pick on math. Like I'll pick on English because I was an English teacher. Like they don't know why they need to read certain novels, you know, and who decided that one thing was more important than another thing or that one set of facts. What all of them will say is, I wish somebody would teach me how to manage money, you know, how to do math that's real.
Sure.
That's like the kind of stuff that, what is the stuff that regular people need all the time? And that we don't have a class for that. We didn't at my school.
Sure.
So yeah, I feel like there's a number of assumptions, and that's not even getting into more troubling questions of whose version of history and all of that as
right.
well.
Right. And we also have to be careful not to get into, you know, the goal isn't for us to identify what should the curriculum be, right? Because then you're still stuck in this idea of a curriculum. And that's the other piece, right? In terms of the importance and value of the process, of the learning process when it's self-directed. You know, kids getting to choose and getting to struggle with identifying and pursuing the things that matter to them. And I think that's critical. I mean, learning, when people say learning, it seems like such a superficial kind of, it's just checking the box. When really learning is this generative process that comes from interacting and applying kind of what you are learning. And that really only happens, you know, most of the time in a genuine kind of lasting way when it's done because you actually want to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's relevant to your current life and interests. And so, you know, having, you know, trusting that the kids will come to the topics they need because they will need them, right? And then supporting them, like that in my mind is the goal. And so I, you know, so whenever that concern that you first asked about arises, I first think, well, A, we don't need to know what they need to know in the first place. B, they're not going to remember it even if I did try to, quote, force them to do it. And C, like, recognize the value of this journey, you know? And the importance of not learning particular things, but learning how to learn and learning how to feel that confidence in being able to learn how to learn, among others too, right? And you're not just by yourself, right? Like how to find those resources and community members who can support you in that.
I've been asking a lot of adults, I'll ask you this question, just informally, like what do you know a lot about yourself, to whatever extent? I mean, I don't want to put pressure on like I'm an expert in something, but like what are the things that you know about now that you've learned because you were interested in knowing about them? I mean, we were talking earlier about architecture and you wanting to build an eco house, and I'm sure you're learning tons that you didn't know. Like, what's been something that's been interesting to you lately that you've been learning?
Well, I'll go back to first quickly, kind of one of the reasons why self-directed education resonated so much with me from the start is because reflecting on my own kind of upbringing and education, I recognized that like the only times I was really excited about stuff was when I had the time to kind of figure it out myself. Like over summer breaks, I'd go in the bookstore and just get a pile of books and just go through them and like on topics that I actually cared about, right? And it never occurred to me that, you know, that could be actually what kids, you know, like that there was an alternative. You know, my family, you know, people around me at the time didn't know that that didn't see it as an alternative. But so I kind of have a tendency to have a lot of hobbies and interests and stuff. And so, I mean, yeah, what are the current things? So I'm learning about natural building. And to do that, I've also learned a little bit about CAD and how to use FreeCAD, learning about different building methods and approaches. On a different side, I'm also really interested in language acquisition, and I've been learning this sign language system that is it's a simplified sign language system that that uses iconic signs that which means that the signs are kind of intuitive. When you see them, you can kind of gather what they mean. And so I'm interested in using those signs to improve language acquisition. So when you accompany a new vocabulary word with an iconic sign, it enhances retention. And so
is it used with like little kids?
The system was only recently published. It's by John Bonvillian. There's an open source. The book is Creative Commons license, so you can freely download it. It was originally developed to be used with, I think, people with different kind of different cognitive deficits, or in places where where they were struggling to communicate with words, and so it was first developed to be a system to kind of facilitate that. That's another thing that I'm interested in at the moment.
Cool.
But yeah, but I'm a magician as well. I'm a professional magician. I do meditation.
You are?
And yeah, so I've kind of always had different random stuff. Yeah.
I don't think I've ever met a professional magician before.
Now you have. Yeah.
So we're here at the Anarchy Zone, a place that I really love. Rusty described it earlier, and kind of what it's like. There's just lots of stuff, old tires and tubes and wood and lots of little hills, and it's a little bit rougher. It's pretty rough around the edges, and it's modular, so it's just moving all the time. Your kids are how old?
3 and 7.
3 and 7, and you bring them here sometimes. What do you notice a difference in the way that they play here compared to the way that they play at another park that's more of a conventional sort of park?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely more creative, right? I mean, it's more generative. They're trying to figure out what they can do with the space, and you have more options to do different things. Part of me wants to say that they enjoy it more, but I don't know. Maybe that's my bias. I feel like they would likely enjoy it more. But yeah, I mean, they love it, and they love being able to kind of just interact in real time with the space that they're in, and to kind of co-construct that space.
Rusty said that he was telling me about a PhD project that somebody studied, the same group of kids playing here and at another park, and it's something he's noticed a lot before as well, that it confirmed that in a conventional park, kids kind of get bored after about 20 minutes. They run through everything, you know, they do all the stuff that monkey bars and slides and swings do, and then they've done it. And here he says that they just keep going like that, and there's less fights. And I guess they measured this in this study, that the kids were just really absorbed in the work that they were doing.
Sure.
Is that something you've seen in your kids as well?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, and it makes sense from a psychological perspective. You could look at like the flow literature, like Csikszentmihalyi's work on flow. It looks at how, you know, you become immersed in some activity when your skills kind of are balanced with the degree of challenge. Like, it's a challenging thing, and you have kind of just enough skill to do it. And so the beauty of a space like this is that you can always make things more difficult, and that's what you and in the process you kind of up your own skills in the process, which means you then look for something even more challenging. And so it's this kind of natural upward spiral, which you lack in a fixed playground space where you can try to figure out different ways to play with the equipment, but it's very limited, right? It totally makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, we were talking about how he was saying that, you know, that desire for greater risk, for pushing, just for finding our limits, you know, finding is just a natural part of development. And I was reminded of playing on a swing set when I was a kid. And yeah, you swing as high as you can swing and you make it kind of do that jolt where it's hanging suspended and then it drops down again. But you can only go so far. You know, we dreamed about doing this full spiral around, but we couldn't do it. So I remember just not like stopping swinging and just climbing because it was a pretty high, like too high up. Mm-hmm. The top of, to try to climb all the way up to the top of this metal swing set. I was interested, as we were talking about that, he was saying that there's often more injuries, more serious injuries in regular playgrounds, even though that seems counterintuitive, because kids are always pushing for risk, more risk, you know, that's kind of just a built-in. And in those spaces, we tend to sort of trust the infrastructure, even when we're doing things that the infrastructure was not made to do. So like the padded ground under the swing set was made for you to fall off of it from 3 feet high, not from 10 feet high,
yeah.
Where kids would push it. Whereas here, you just felt like there's an engagement with the environment that stays more engaged. And that an awareness of like, is this safe? Is that safe? I'm not sure.
Sure.
That kind of assessment all the time.
Sure.
Is
sure.
happening.
Yeah, right. And you could also... you'd also expect to see differences for kids who spend more time in general in these sorts of spaces and have the opportunity to kind of gain self-awareness around, you know, what their abilities are. You know, so I'd be interested to compare groups of kids who spend a lot of time, you know, over long period of time in a space like this versus kids who just come here. Like, you'd also expect more injuries from kids who just come here on occasion who are used to those other spaces as well.
Right.
Because they're not.
And I'm wondering too, I mean, now that you use that, did you use the word confidence? I wonder if the confidence also translates. So back to like self-directed learning in school, it seems like there's so many parallels, I feel like, with playground spaces. I think that this is such an interesting mix of a conversation because like how much confidence somebody can grow in themselves. Like a confidence that like, I know my body, I know that I can do this safely, this thing, or climb this tree or build this structure. A kid that has confidence in himself or herself versus somebody who doesn't, you know, isn't that the same? I mean, aren't there a lot of parallels with learning and confidence in, I was asking a student who does kind of a homeschooling where she does a day, I think one day a week co-op, kind of thing with some teachers on a couple particular subjects. And I was telling her about this kind of school. And I said, is that something you would like? She's 15. And she said, I don't know that I could trust myself, that I wouldn't just waste time. So she had really internalized that message. And maybe she's right, you know? But it made me wonder, like, is that just the nature of a 15-year-old? Or is that a 15-year-old who's been conditioned to not really trust yourself? I don't know if that makes sense.
Sure. Well, who decides what wasting time means?
Yeah.
In some ways the bigger question. We have such a kind of focus on outcomes in our society that if something isn't directly leading to, you know, outcomes that our society considers of worth, then it's not productive and thus a waste of time. So,
I was in a kind of a college prep school, high school, and even though it was overseas, so it definitely had more openness toward doing a gap year after college, which isn't really something I don't think that happens that much yet in the U.S. But there was definitely a suspicion of, and not just a suspicion of taking time off, because there was always the fear, like what if they don't go. Well, maybe they weren't supposed to then if that's going to be the thing. But also, so it's just an inertia. Like, we'll keep it going and that'll be why you stay in higher education. I do feel like there's, at least in a college prep school, a sort of elite, like a snobbiness about careers that you have to have a college degree to get. But some of that feels so absurd. You know, if you think about somebody kind of working in a sort of in a communications department in a in an office setting. I'm not picking on communications or any, a lot of things where you have a bachelor's degree in something and now you work in an office. Like, that job is esteemed in some way culturally. Whereas being a carpenter or a tradesman, which often is just so much more, like, it's a really rich set of skills and knowledge that people need for that. I don't know. I feel like we're still, our culture still really esteems people that work in an office versus those who don't, even when the actual knowledge and skills involved aren't any more impressive, and sometimes are less.
Sure.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's like a college degree is now like the new high school degree. You know, like, before, everyone had to, you know, graduate high school, and now everyone has to graduate college. And but it's very, it's performative, you know, it's not necessarily because they need those things. Like I said before, I finished college and I didn't feel ready to do anything. So I was glad I was going to grad school. So I had, you know, that inertia, and I didn't have to worry about actually being useful at that point. But
I'm sure you remember everything from grad school.
Well, grad school, particularly when I got into my doctoral studies, was the first time that it was really self-directed. Like, mm-hmm. I was getting to choose, like, I was designing my own research and choosing. And so I actually really dug that. And the topic, you know, the coursework there was stuff that I really wanted to do. And it was really connected to kind of the career that I thought I wanted at the time. It's not mm-hmm. what I am doing now. But so that was the first time when it was actually self-directed. And you know, so, you know, I'm not against, you know, college or graduate school, but one of the great benefits of, you know, self-directed education is helping kids to identify what does matter to them so that they can make sure that, you know, their college studies, you know, is that in line with their interests and passions and where they want to go.
How many people, I mean, have we met as adults who are doing what they went to school to do?
Yeah.
Or who are totally switched gears. You know, I know a guy who was working carpentry, home building through college, and he got into his first job in an office, and he hated it.
Sure.
It was pastoral work, and he loved the work with people, but he just really hated, like, all of the being indoors all the time, and just realized that he loved working with his hands.
Yeah.
It's sad that he never had the opportunity to figure that out or experience it, or just to get an opportunity to try it earlier.
Right.
Did you read Ken's book, Ken Danford's book, about North Star?
No.
So he tells a story, I think, in that book about a kid in their program who was really into fishing, loves to fish. Mm. And he would go fishing a couple days a week. He would be out fishing all day, which is something, you know, of course, that most people would hear that and be like, you're letting kids go fishing all day long? But what he also liked was he started getting into being to filming the rivers around Amherst, you know, with a drone, like the drone footage of overhead. And he got really into that too. So videography and aerial photography and stuff. And so it started with him filming himself kind of up from above. But North Star was able to connect him with, like, well, what if we, you know, the surrounding communities might want some footage for their websites of their town and et cetera. So they connected them to him, to those people, which led to some internship opportunities to get real life experience doing that work.
Yeah.
I think an alumna of the school was working in film in California and wanted an intern from North Star. And so I think he ended up working with her. Like, these things led in such an organic way.
Sure.
And whether he's doing professional fishing or professional videography or wherever he is now, you just think he's had opportunities, you know, to learn things. And I just think, like, hardly any of us have ever got those chances when we were younger, certainly.
Right.
Yeah, it's one of the things that really excites me about self-directed learning, too.
Right. And again, that's where you have to have the faith, like the trust that, like, that even though you might not see, you know, what, you know, usable skills are they getting from a particular interest they're pursuing, like, you just have to trust that it will happen. And that's the big challenge, you know? And maybe they won't get any useful skills out of a particular activity, but so what? You know, I mean, they're going to, you know, they're still going to be developing and learning from the experience, even if it's in a way that we don't see, you know? I mean, there's still important experiences, but our society is so focused on the outcomes, even though those outcomes are typically just very kind of short-term focused, you know, and they're not really supporting the long-term well-being of the child.
A lot of the outcomes support a paper trail that the teacher can show that they, or the school district or the principal, you know, all the way up the chain, that we're doing our job.
Right.
I feel like a lot of the grading that's done and all that, that's what's underneath it.
And I feel like some of the, you know, much of that is because, like if you didn't capture that, you know, you couldn't look at them, you know, years down the line and say that they learned anything because they forgot most of it. So you have to capture it right then and there.
Evidence that I taught this successfully to these children.
Like I don't know why he doesn't remember now, but look, see, he got an A on the test.
What's wrong with him?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're going to, what's your timeline on wanting to open your own learning center?
We're hoping to.
If everything went as planned.
Yeah, so right now, this starting, you know, with the new academic year right now, we're this will be our kind of outreach year, and we're kind of forming some partnerships and identifying a location, and we're hoping by next fall to be fully operational.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So are you looking to rent a space in a like a church or some other kind of setting?
Maybe. We're also in conversation with the local, with another nonprofit that is interested in having an education facility and is interested in self-directed education. And so we might partner with them, and they may have better access to spaces. So we're hoping that might happen. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So what, like, are you far enough along to what have you been imagining? Like, what does it feel like? What does it look like? Maybe, I don't know how much you've imagined that or not.
Yeah. I mean, we see it as kind of, we really want to have a nature connection focus as well. And I know that's often hard in, you know, many self-directed education centers are in kind of big cities where it's hard to find that nature space. And so we're really hoping that we'll be able to do that so that, you know, kids are, even if they're not forced to do stuff, you know, in nature, they're surrounded by it, and they're, you know, the facilitators and other adults involved in the community are, some of them are themselves, you know, deeply connected with the natural world and can serve as mentors for, to kind of help kids to form those connections. So we kind of have, you know, the nature connection focus. We also would really like the space to be intergenerational beyond just mixed age. So we want it to be a space where, you know, young adults, older adults, retirees can come and share, you know, the things they're passionate about, can learn new things, can reskill. So we really want it to be kind of in the long run, we really want it to be kind of this intergenerational space where kids see adults, you know, also excited to be learning new things.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just having, you know, paid or volunteer facilitators there who are doing it. So that's another important piece. We also do want to create opportunities for kids to explore different kind of entrepreneurial kind of, you know, try out a new business, particularly kind of social entrepreneurship, helping support them to identify issues, you know, in the world, things that, you know, about the status quo that they're not happy with, and how can we support them in you know, trying new things out, you know, and doing so in an efficient way. I have some background with business and entrepreneurship stuff, so kind of guiding them in that process. We're hoping to have a few kind of regenerative businesses that anyone in the community who wants to participate can participate in whatever capacity, whether it's the marketing side or the actual kind of, you know, if we're building a house, they could be building the house, or they could be marketing the house. They could be, you know, so that there are different options, and none of that would be forced on any kid, certainly. But if they want to, then they can, you know, and that's where the kind of intergenerational piece comes in. You know, we'd have some adult community members who are largely there because that's what they're excited about, and they want to be involved in some of these kind of community-based regenerative businesses, for mm-hmm. example.
I mean, I would think that so many retirees, say, not even just them, but thinking of them for a second, would love to share their knowledge.
Sure.
Maybe they don't have grandkids, or they're far away, or they don't know any children, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. And just like, but would just relish the opportunity to share that with young people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes you're feeling like you don't know what to do if you're retired and you can only play so much golf, and then,
yeah. Yeah. No, I think the loss of that connection between kids and adults, for that matter, with elders in the community is really significant and something that we'd like to try to figure out how do we facilitate, create a space where that makes it easy for, kids and elders and, to be interacting and, in a way that feels good for everyone and where everyone can learn when they want, what they want to learn and just, have kind of a healthy kind of functioning community, essentially.
All right. Hey, thanks. Thanks so much for this conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
It was so cool to meet you in person. I'm now a big fan. I mean, I was kind of on Zoom, but we were only together for the week of training. But I'm really excited to come back and see your school, your learning center. What is it? Do you have a name yet?
Communitas. Yeah.
Okay. So, Communitas.
Our website is thisiscommunitas.org.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, I will keep that in a tab open for that and checking it out.
Cool.
And I'd love to get back. This is such a pretty place. I can see that this being a great space for the access to nature.
Yeah.
You don't get, in Chicago, you have to go pretty far out of the sprawl,
right,
to get to anything. But man, having everything just right here is pretty, and having a cool playground like this.
Yeah.
It's a pretty neat place for it.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Well, thank
Best
you, Steven.
Of luck.
Yeah,
Thanks
no,
so
I
much.
It.
After Matt left, I was packing up my gear and preparing to leave when I stopped to watch a group of children playing. When I had arrived earlier in the day, the playground manager had been helping a couple of small kids stack some heavy tractor tires and tie down plastic tubing with ropes. Now he was sitting nearby watching these older kids carrying on with the project. He later told me that this was an after-school group from a nearby elementary school. I pulled out my recorder to describe the scene. So I'm at the Anarchy Zone in Ithaca, New York, and I've just had a couple of great conversations with Rusty and Matt, in part about play and about learning and about different kinds of play. And I just wanted to stick around because a bunch of kids just showed up. They're all elementary kids, about 6 to 10 years old, and there's maybe 10 of them, and they're working on a thing. That's it's basically like the main structure is about six or eight tractor tires, like 4 foot wide tractor tires, and then a bunch of tubing, like it looks like flexible tubing, but it's big construction tubing. It's black tubing that's about 3 feet in diameter. I wish you could see it. There's the kids are all engaged. They're all working on this one thing, this one structure, and it goes about three tires high. So it runs probably at the highest, it's about 4 feet off the ground or 5 feet off the ground, 5 feet. And it's tethered together. Jason, the manager of the playground, was working on it earlier today with a little three-year-old who was helping him build it. He was just starting to stack it. The adults in playgrounds like this only work, only intervene really as they're needed. If something gets particularly dangerous, or if something is just too heavy for kids to lift, or they're struggling with something in a way that they can't manage. So he tethered it together with some ropes to kind of shore it up and strengthen it. But they've hooked together a bunch of sections of this tubing into like a snaky kind of tube slide that they're building. And they're finding little stumps to rest it on, trying to get the pitch right. There's just so much activity and so much work. They're climbing on the top of it. They're trying to slide through it. They're just working. They're busy. One boy is rolling a new stump over. There's just a purposefulness to this work that I think is
pretty stunning compared to most playgrounds. Each kid seems really interested. It doesn't seem like there's any issue with playing across ages. They're all just active and engaged and working. They're negotiating things. What if we did this? What if we did that? One of them is just adding a slide on one end. They've got a section of just standard plastic slide material, but it's not attached to anything, so it can be moved around. Jason was telling me that nothing here is static. It's always in motion. It's always changing. And so as the kids are playing, some of them are, they're using it in different ways. Some of them are really getting into more imaginative play. Some of them are just interested in the building and the structure. Some of them are kind of hiding out underneath or in one of the tubes, like a little cave or a little clubhouse. There's a section of ladder, just a simple ladder, a wooden spool, a big spool that electric cabling comes in. Walking further down, there's more of a little fort over here with sticks and material, just some cloth, a bed sheet maybe. So two kids are trying to figure out, I think, what they're going to do next over on some big, heavy, fallen down trees and some bridge material. It looks like some 2x4s with crossbars, some railing, just kind of pieces, chunks of stuff that some of them are easy for one kid to move. Some of them need multiple children to carry something or drag it along. But this play space is constantly in flux. It's constantly in motion, and the kids just don't seem to be getting bored. I am reminded of Rusty saying that these kids routinely just go and go and go until they have to leave, rather than just getting bored after a short time. Yeah, it's a really, really neat, fun space. One girl is taking a wooden pallet. It's resting in the center on a rock, and she's kind of stepping on it and riding it almost back and forth, like it's because it's rocking back and forth and it's real unsteady. I love the fact that there's not a fear that a kid might fall and get bruised or scraped a little bit. Talking to Jason a few minutes ago, he said that they do for sure get smaller scale, you know, scrapes and bumps, as you would playing in this way, but they don't tend to get large, major injuries, which is what Rusty said before. Jason has four kids who all played here, and now he works here, helping to manage this wonderful play space. Thanks so much for joining me for episode 2 of the Envisioning Education Podcast. Thanks to Matt Jarman for sharing his vision for Communitas. If you'd like to learn more, his website is thisiscommunitas.org. That is thisiscommunitas.org. All lowercase, no spaces. He has a short video on that site titled "How Can Self-Directed Learning Possibly Work?" that you might find helpful. Talking to Matt has been helpful for me. He's someone who's several steps ahead of me, but is not yet running a center. I'm sure that if I proceed with launching something of my own in Chicago, I'll be back in touch with him with a bunch of follow-up questions. Thanks so much for joining me today on the Envisioning Education Podcast.